In this part of the show, we'll be doing our monthly program on personal finance. We've just switched the hours around this morning. It's the right day. It's just a different time. We changed things just so we could do that conversation in the first part of the show with journalist Michaela Wrong about talking with her about her book about Congo. So in this part of the show, we'll be inviting your questions on money management and investing. And we have sitting in as guest this time around Kevin Waspy. He's a lecturer in the Department of Finance at the University of Illinois. He's been with the university since 1996. He teaches courses in financial markets, investments, and employee benefits. And before that, he worked for a number of different financial institutions here in the community. And he's been good enough to sit in again. He was here with us in March, I believe, and was so good, we just decided we had to have him come back. So it's the usual kind of deal. If you have questions about investing, this is your opportunity to call in and get some advice from Kevin and sample some of his opinions about what's going on in financial markets. The questions are open, and the numbers are 333-9455. That's for Champaign Urbana. And we also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So we'll save you money on the call. Locally, 333-WILO, and toll-free 800-222-WILO. Well, thanks very much for coming back.
Thanks for having me. I always like to be here, David.
Well, you were here last in March, so it's been a couple of months. How do things look now as compared to how things were looking then?
Well, we've seen the continuation of the Federal Reserve's actions to lower interest rates. They're diligent in their efforts to keep the economy from falling into recession. Just this week, of course, the fifth cut in the rates that they control, and the economy is continuing to show signs of steadiness, I guess would be the way to put it. Markets have reacted favorably, and you know, people are feeling a little bit better than perhaps they did in March.
Okay. Well, we have somebody here on a car phone, so we want to get right to them. It's line number one. Hello.
Hello. I have sort of a big picture question. I'm 39 years old and am trying to save money for retirement. I get about 12% of my annual salary each year put into a retirement pension fund. And I save then about another 18% of my gross salary separately in a retirement fund. And my question is, looking at the long term for retirement, I currently have most of my money in growth funds that are have done pretty bad the last year, not surprisingly. Over the long run, should I stay with the strategy now of maintaining myself in pretty clear growth funds with the thought that somewhere 10 or 15 years down the road, I'd move to a more conservative investment portfolio?
That's, well, two things very striking. The amount at which you're saving is tremendous. You should be commended for not only the employer-sponsored retirement plan that you're saving, but certainly the personal savings on top of that. I mean, you know, just looking at anybody saving 30% of income in today's day and age is very unusual, so I commend you on that. To the second issue, your age would tell me that unless you want to retire by the time you're 45 years old, you're easily going to achieve the goals that you'll achieve despite what has happened most recently with things like growth stock mutual funds. So the words I would use would be things like encouragement, diligence, and stick to a plan. It sounds like you've got a great plan. And don't let the temporary ups and downs dissuade you from it.
All right. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Thank you.
Other questions are welcome. 333-WILL, toll free, 800-222-WILL. I guess that maybe leads to an area we might talk about. And I guess the general recommendation is that probably still most people, unless you're very, very close to retirement, should be substantially invested in stocks. But there's a great deal of latitude in what you can put your money into, and more obviously, if you're willing to take more risk, theoretically, mm-hmm. the returns should be better, and that maybe you sacrifice a little bit of your return for more security. But when you look at the possibilities, and say you've decided that you want to target your money a little bit more narrowly rather than doing something like a total market index or the S&P 500 fund or something like that that's going to invest broadly. How do you think about where, depending on who you are, where you want to put your money.
Mm-hmm. That's a great question, and maybe just to follow up not only on that, but with the caller's mention that he just made, with the focus he has, he's obviously wanted to accept a little bit more risk at the present, going into, and of course we didn't get into details, but the assumption that I'll make is that a majority, if not all of the money that he's investing now for retirement purposes is going into a more aggressive stock fund that's a growth-oriented type of fund. I guess the mention that I would make along those lines and with what you've just said is there is probably a good process that a person should think through in advance that gets to fine-tuning. In other words, as we get closer and closer to our goals, we'll start to back off on some of the aggressive allocations that we have. And it may be something as simple as just reallocating those new monies going into those retirement plans rather than selling what we have as a holding. If we look at the opportunity a person has on a regular basis to put money away, that can be a very effective tool to tune a person's overall portfolio toward a little less volatile and a little less risky portfolio without altering the actual holdings that they've built up in the early years of the formation of it. So the bottom line is, yes, as we get closer to retirement, people should start thinking about fine-tuning, and that would be more allocation toward either more mundane or safer stock funds, certainly into more fixed income, and possibly even into cash alternatives. If there's one thing to be learned from the past couple of years' stock market activity, that is those people that were on the threshold of retirement who had most or all of their money in very aggressive funds are very upset right now. And at a situation where a person's very close to retirement, I would say they should be planning on having a good portion of their money in cash equivalents, so that they don't have to tap those types of aggressive funds during a time when the market's down and they have to be selling them at a loss. And that's all, again, a part of the tuning process that doesn't mean we have to make gross shifts through time, but just fine-tuning the actual allocations of where the monies go as they're put away each month.
Okay. Other questions are certainly welcome. Our guest, Kevin Wasby, he's a lecturer in finance in the Department of Finance here at University of Illinois. Questions, welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Next caller up is in Champaign on line one. Hello.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was wondering, I read an article in the paper that said that mortgage rates are not driven by what the Fed does, and I was wondering if you could offer any insight into what drives mortgage rates, and how come I'm buying a house now, and how come, when Greenspan says things are going down that I can't get a better rate. Just any comments you have, and I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Okay.
That's a great question, and there's been a lot of confusion in, what has been the activity of the Federal Reserve this year. I mean, my goodness, five different times the Federal Reserve's taken action to, quote-unquote, lower interest rates, and as simple as a statement as that is, it's a very complex relationship. Here's the bottom line. Let's remember that the tools the Federal Reserve is operating with are very, very short-term interest rates, and they are targets on very short-term interest rates. So when they pull a lever and the expectation is interest rates will fall, it is in the very short-term maturity end of the market. As an example, at the beginning of the year, 90-day Treasury bills were yielding 5.66%. Right now, 90-day Treasury bills are near 3.7%. So there's certainly been a decline there. The prime interest rate that banks charge, 9.5% at the beginning of the year, currently 7% right now. So those kinds of obvious rates have definitely come down. Now let's talk about mortgage rates. The mortgage market is a related but very different market. Affecting mortgage rates are things like the supply of mortgage money and, of course, the demand for it. And housing starts and housing purchases have held up well, so there's a good demand for mortgage money now. Bottom line is the relationship is there, but certainly not a one-for-one relationship. A closer tangent to a relationship to mortgage interest rates would be the interest rates on things like long-term Treasury bonds. So again, back to the first of the year, 30-year Treasury bonds were yielding 5.44%. I believe if we were to look them up now, they'd be yielding about 5.8%. So they've actually risen in the period of time that the Fed's taken this overt action to lower interest rates in our economy. So here's where we're at. I believe when I looked at the mortgage monitor in the local paper here just over the weekend, I was seeing 30-year mortgage money at roughly 6.75%, fixed rate loan, no points. And I look at it and say, well, you're probably within 0.75 percentage point of that being the low in the present cycle of interest rates. If that's the case, remember, when you borrow money on a house, a mortgage loan that's a fixed rate loan, it's always a lose-lose situation for the lender. That makes you the borrower the winner. If interest rates go down even more, you can refinance the loan and lock in a lower rate. If interest rates stay the same or rise, you're a happy camper because your rate stays at, let's say, 6.75%. So rather than trying to time a market move in interest rates as it goes to mortgages, basically say if you're in the market to buy a house now, console yourself in saying that you're probably very near the low ebb of interest rates for mortgage money. Go ahead, get a fixed rate loan, get the loan that makes sense for you and your circumstance, and remember that if rates go lower and they go low enough, you can refinance it and reap the benefit of having that happen. And if rates don't go lower, then you can just sit pat with that fixed rate loan.
You don't have any idea what sort of ballpark closing costs are on refinancing these days?
On refis, I don't know. And it's again, gotten to be a very competitive market for mortgages. And I think it's the ultimate opportunity a consumer has for shopping.
Okay.
Check around. There are countless mortgage lenders that are always trying to compete for your business.
And is now still the general rule of thumb apply that if you can lower the rate that you're paying by by 1%, that at least you should think about it?
Oh, very definitely. A percent would certainly put it in the category, I think, where a person would do the serious shopping of a refinance. And, of course, that would have to be buffered with their desire to live in the house. In other words, if they saw a career change maybe 2 or 3 years down the road that would mean that they'd be selling the house, relocating, then even a percentage point change in an interest rate may not make it worth their while to refinance. If they feel that they're in the area and going to stay in that house for quite some time, then certainly it's at that stage where they should be looking.
All right. We have other callers here. Next is another Champagne person. This is line two.
Hello.
Yes.
I think maybe this is a rather naive question, but if you're the recipient of the proceeds of a life insurance policy, then that money is going to be taxed as ordinary income, right?
No. If you're the beneficiary of a life insurance policy, the proceeds at death on the insured, that is, come to the beneficiary tax-free.
Well, they do.
Yes.
Now, if you and your spouse had a whole life policy that you'd been paying on for a number of years, and at some point you decided not, you know, to cash this in and reinvest the money, then I presume that all the profit, you know, everything that you hadn't put in as payment on the policy then would be taxed.
Right, right. That's a very different situation, and you bring up an excellent point. When a person surrenders a life insurance policy, anything over and above what their actual cost basis would be in it, and it's not as simple as the premiums paid. It's a rather lengthy calculation. The insurance agent should be very willing and helpful in walking you through that calculation. But the bottom line is the cash value buildup that's occurred within the policy is then taxable income if it is surrendered.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a very different circumstance than having a beneficiary receive the proceeds at the event of death.
I see. So the beneficiary's proceeds are not taxed.
That is correct.
That's good news. Okay, well, thank you very much.
All right.
You're welcome.
Very good. On to caller here in Champaign, line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Can you tell me, how do lower interest rates affect Ginnie Mae funds? With everybody, well, so many people refinancing, does that hurt or help them?
Ginnie Mae funds are peculiar animals. Let me see if I can go through a Ginnie Mae without becoming too confusing.
Okay, I'll hang up and listen. Right?
Okay.
Okay, well, thanks for the call.
Ginnie Mae, the acronym, Government National Mortgage Association, GNMA, what we have here is a pool of mortgages The mortgages themselves are insured by the government National Mortgage Association, Ginnie Mae, as to the timely payment of interest and principal. And as an investor in Ginnie Mae's, a person buys a participation certificate. Or in the context of a mutual fund, the manager of the mutual fund is buying those pass-through certificates. And then, of course, each person in the mutual fund owns a pro rata share in that. Bottom line is, an investor in a Ginnie Mae receives monthly payments that are in part principal and in part interest. And that is because the underlying assets being invested in are literally individuals' home mortgages. So as a mortgage payer, each month you pay your payment. Part of that is interest. Part of that is principal. Now, in just a few moments ago, we talked with a person in the housing market, and I made the mention of a person who is a borrower with a fixed-rate mortgage is in the win-win situation. The lender is a lose-lose situation. And what I meant to say with that was, from the perspective of the borrower, if interest rates go down, they are free and completely able to refinance the loan, pay it off entirely, and get a loan with a cheaper interest rate. So as the lender goes, they no longer have the opportunity to receive those interest payments at that higher than market rate. As it goes to interest rates rising, the lender again is the loser, because that money that the person borrowed now at a below market interest rate is a fixed rate. They can't go out and say, hey, you know, market rates have risen, I'd like to charge you a little bit more interest. So as an investor in Ginnie Mae's, put yourself in the place of the bank. That's exactly what you're doing. You're lending money to fixed rate mortgage borrowers. You are in the lose-lose situation. Now, that doesn't mean that Ginnie Mae's are inappropriate investments, but it means that they have to be treated very differently than traditional fixed income investments. They have to be viewed with an eye toward the potential to have a losing value investment if interest rates rise, because it's a fixed rate investment and the price varies inversely with yields. But when interest rates fall, have the possibility that the rate falling would not allow the price of the Ginnie Mae investment to rise, the value of it to rise, because so many of those mortgages would then be going into prepayment status. The investor, in that sense, would be receiving their principal back faster, and they would need to then go out into a lower interest rate environment and find a place to invest it. So the price or value of Ginnie Mae investments tends to be rather loaded against those people that are the investors in them. It just has to be looked at as a peculiar animal in a person's asset allocation.
Okay. Hope that gets to the question of the caller. And other folks have questions, you can call us. The guest here this morning is Kevin Wasby. He's a lecturer in the Department of Finance at University of Illinois. This is our regular monthly program on personal finance. We just switch the hours around. Instead of doing it at 10, we're doing it at 11, but it's the same sort of thing. Kevin teaches courses in financial markets and investments and the employee benefits at the University of Illinois. So if you have questions about those kind of things, you can give us a call here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's for local folks. But if you would be making a long-distance call, use our toll-free line, and we'll pay for the call, 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. We were talking a little bit earlier about the fact that if you're going to be investing in stocks, but at certain times of your life, particularly if you're getting closer to the point where you think you're going to retire, you want to be invested in things that are going to be more stable, less volatile, with lower risk. And I wonder if you're in something like a fund, say an S&P 500 fund. So this means that you're investing in the 500 biggest companies, mm-hmm. or even a total market index where you're investing broadly in the market, but it's my understanding that it's still weighted towards the bigger companies. Would you consider that to be in a traditional sense, a secure, stable, low risk kind of thing to put your money in?
As exposure to equities goes, it's probably the bread and butter exposure to stocks. It's certainly the most common and probably with the highest correlation to basic economic growth. So if we were to look not at sectors of the economy, we're not trying to discern whether energy or technology is going to be the fastest growing sector. But we're overall looking at the growth in the economy. Those types of approaches would happen to be the approaches that best fit our general economic level of productivity and prosperity. So a bet, an investment in that form, is not a bet on a particular pocket or sector of the economy, but it's just an investment in the economy at large. And as you mentioned, with the S&P 500, with market index funds that are even broader than that, there is a concentration in those larger firms because, for the most part, these are value-weighted investments, meaning to say that if a certain area of the economy is made up for in a larger part by energy, let's say, as opposed to some other sector of the economy, then that's how the funds are invested. It's the market weighting of the companies in those industries as to how the funds are actually investing the shareholders' dollars.
Yeah. If for example, you were going to invest in an S&P 500 fund, the thinking would be here that, these are big companies. A lot of these companies have been Microsoft is in there, but also a lot of the other companies are companies that have been around for a long, long time. So you figure, well, these probably will continue to be around mm-hmm. for a long time. But if your bottom line concern was security and stability of the investment, is there something that would be even more solid than the S&P 500?
Well, when we talk about investment in equities, we always have to remember that equities happen to be those risky areas called the ownership of business. Literally, a stockholder is a part owner of a business. And with any business, there's always going to be the risk of that business's profitability. So investment in equity is never going to be removed from the business risk of that actual process. That's why a complete portfolio should always involve elements that are also in fixed income investments. So bonds, some cash equivalents, perhaps equities that are outside of the United States. And here we're not trying to necessarily find safer stocks per se, but we're trying to find stocks and stock markets that may move less than perfectly lockstep with our own. So now, in terms of the advantages of diversification, we have the less than perfect positive correlation in the movements of the markets. So the example being, if our market doesn't do so well, perhaps another equity market outside of the United States is either doing better or not as poorly. And obviously that diversification is all a part of different asset classes, as well as the international aspect of diversification that means more than the United States. So there are many ways for a person to maintain exposure and have growth opportunities, but still, how should we say, back off from the all-out bet that they might make by having everything in one, even broadly based market, full market index or S&P 500. So yeah, the diversification opportunities are certainly there, but a person should always say to themselves that investing as a process has a long-term positive expected payoff. That doesn't say anything about those shorter time periods in between, though. So those volatility elements have to be taken into account.
To another caller here, Muhammad, line number one. Hello.
Hello. I'm not sure if you've already discussed this or not, but before Alan Greenspan dropped things another half point, 30-year mortgage rates were at 7 1/8, and now they're at 7 1/4. Do you think it's going to change? I want to refinance.
Mortgage markets, again, are a little bit divorced from actual Fed actions. I mean, they're certainly interest rate markets, in terms of where interest rates are headed, I don't think the trend for interest rates is going to turn around and go back higher anytime soon. I think the most recent uptick in mortgage rates is probably a temporary phenomenon. Let's recall what time of year this is. The month of May, I'm sure home sales as a seasonal item are a lot more than so in February. So, you know, there are elements that enter into the mortgage market that go beyond what Alan Greenspan and the rest of the Federal Reserve governors do. Bottom line is this. If you're in the mortgage market right now, you know, it's a good time. If you're borrowing at 7 1/8 and no points, or 6 3/4 and no points, you know, a fixed rate mortgage over either 15 or 30 years, you're not talking a huge difference in terms of the per month payment. And the bottom line is, if you do establish a fixed rate mortgage right now and interest rates for mortgage money continue to fall, let's say 6 months, a year down the road, you're in the driver's seat. You know, you have the perfect opportunity to go reprice that loan lower to yourself and refinance.
Well, at $1,000 to refinance, it's a little difficult to do.
Well, again, that depends on how long you're going to be in the house, how you allocate that $1,000 over the course of the future, and how many months it takes you in savings on the monthly payment to make that back. So you're absolutely right. It's a fine-tuning decision that is very personal and very particular to your circumstance.
All right. Thank you for your help.
All right. Thank you. And other questions, again, are welcome. 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL.
Yeah, I guess just to, if sure. I could, David, sure. You know, on the mention of mortgage money and refinancing and such, I mean, I didn't want to leave people with the impression that refinancing a mortgage was something you do as often as perhaps cut your grass. That's not where I'm at here. But recall that most people borrow mortgage money for a term of either 30 or 15 years. And in the grand plan of things, you know, the opportunities to refinance over that period, or even in a period much shorter, let's say 5 years, give a person an opportunity to really be in control of their destiny, much more so than they believe. And I think there's probably a little bit of an overemphasis to people seeing, well, gee, last week the mortgage monitor said that I could have gotten money for 6 7/8, and now it's clear up to 7 1/8. It's not that critical. It really isn't. So, yeah, if we see something and say, well, gee, I could have bought it at 99 cents last week when it was on sale, and now it's back to its regular price of $1.09, what does it really mean in terms of a change in your lifestyle? For most people, the answer is probably nothing. So, again, as it goes to refinancing a mortgage, don't anticipate doing it as often as you're going to cut your grass. You look at the opportunity that you have in a greater scheme of things, in the big plan, in the big picture, to say that during the course of interest rate cycles in our economy, you'll have ample opportunity to view that as a win-win situation.
All right. Number of other folks getting lined up here. We have another car phone, so we'll get right back there. Line one, hello.
Good morning. I have an 11-year-old son who has been saving pretty diligently for college. He's got a little over $2,000 in his savings account, and he'd like to earn a little bit more interest. What's perhaps the best approach for him to take at this point?
Well, with an 11-year-old, I mean, we could say that he's potentially 7 years away from the start of college. I think two things to remember. Number one, it sounds like a long time when we say 7 years, but then again, we know that time goes faster than we care it to go sometimes, and I think that'll probably be the case. The bottom line is, I would think that there's a part or potential that money has to go into something more aggressive. If it's a broadly diversified index type of stock mutual fund, that might be fine. $2,000 is not a huge sum of money, but there are opportunities for a part of that to go into some exposure to equities. Some of it should be kept from that type of risk, and maybe now looking at something like a medium-term type of bond mutual fund might be an opportunity for it. More importantly than that, though, is my hopes are that with an 11-year-old's $2,000 savings opportunity from parents, grandparents, aunts, uncles, so on and so forth, the opportunity to continue that investment will continue over the coming 7 years before college is upon us. And the bottom line is some of those funds, and you know, it's up to you in terms of how you want to allocate it, of course, but some of the funds, I think, ought to be dedicated to a continual saving program so that process of saving for the future is something that you instill in your son for the lifetime. I made a deal with my 10-year-old as an example. I said, okay, fine, all of the money that you make this summer cutting grass, half of it goes straight into the bank, as I call it. Well, I'm the bank. So I take care of the money and I invest it for him. The other half he can do with as he wishes. And right now, I'm looking at it and saying I'm hoping that I'm instilling some lifelong trends, some habits here that go to his future, not only for college purposes, but for all of his life.
Actually, I agree with you, and our deal with our children is that we will match whatever they place in their savings account. So that helps quite a bit. My son is also concerned that his name be on his accounts. He has a real interest that this is his money. I don't know if children his age are allowed to hold their own accounts in their own names. Is that okay?
Well, you can always fool the trustee or custodian as to where the account is. And in other words, it would be possible for you or I to open up an account at a mutual fund company or perhaps even a local savings institution in the name of our 10 or 11-year-old, whichever the case may be, and their Social Security number. I advise against that for a couple of reasons, and I understand where your son's coming from in wanting to have ownership here. But this gets to the nature of trust, too. And the bottom line is, I don't like the titling of the money in the child's name, not only for the legal purposes of it, but also for the unknown down the road purposes. Now, neither one of us would hope that our children turn into people that we wouldn't be proud of, but we don't have a guarantee on that. So at the time my son's 18, I don't want him looking me in the face and in, how should we say, a testosterone-charged moment telling me, well, I'm taking my money and moving to the West Coast, and you and all of the plans Mom and you have for me can go out the window. So I look back on my own life, and there's a nice thing to have with ownership, but there's also the security when, there's adult supervision with it. So keep it in your name. Open the bank account in his name with you as a co-owner. But when the money gets moved from there to a mutual fund company, keep it in your name.
Okay. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. We'll go on here to a caller in southeastern Illinois. This is line number 2. Hello.
Yeah, I was with you 100% until that last answer. I'd say keep the parents' money in their own name and keep the child's money in his name, and if he wants to take off for the West Coast when he's 18, why, that's, by that time, if you haven't instilled in him some pretty good habits, why, you've already botched the job. But anyway.
I'd agree with that. I mean, I'm not trying to have the absolute control. Only thinking back to my own personal situations, And I wasn't ready to pack it in and move to the West Coast either, but I know that, there are opportunities. Everybody has to kind of experience the fit of the moment type decisions.
Yeah.
And I certainly wasn't trying to say that would make up for, 17 and three quarters years learning up to that point, but just a personal belief I have. And certainly, I understand where you're coming from in your situation, too.
What I called in to say was, though, how much I was enjoying the program. I think I must have missed you the first time, and I appreciated your clearest explanation I've ever heard of Jenny May.
Oh, well, thank you.
And also, as I understand, you were talking about those index funds, is they don't simply divide the money among the various stocks, and they divided according to what's going on in the market at the time?
Well, I won't say market at the time, but I would say an index fund allocates the money to the individual stocks on a basis of market valuation. So if the number of shares of XYZ company times the share price of XYZ company means that it's twice as big as ABC company's calculation of market value, then twice as much goes into XYZ as it does ABC.
Okay, so it's the market cap then.
Right, yeah. right, Right. And, those funds are a market value weighting.
And the higher the bigger cap gets more money.
Right.
Okay. One other thing, and I'm sure this is something that there's no question here of an argument, but on these fixed rate, the safety of fixed rate investments, inflation, of course, can wipe you out on that because there's no hiding place down here. I mean, can't it?
Well, sure. Fixed income investments are always subject to the possible erosion from inflation.
Yeah.
If we were to look at the circumstance of the past 75 years, inflation over that 75-year period has averaged about 3% per annum.
Mm-hmm.
Yields on long-term treasuries have averaged around 5% per annum. So as a real rate of return, an investor has gotten about 2% during any single year, or maybe even during single five-year periods, we could find circumstances where those returns wouldn't have been realized in a real sense. Inflation would have eaten it up in the late 70s, early 80s.
Yes.
And that's something to be cognizant of. It's just another reason why Mom told us not to put all our eggs in one basket.
Just one more comment, and I'll get off. I hope that you'll be back as a guest again not too long.
Well, thank you.
But what I was going to say was about no hiding place down here. I mean, in equities, I think the story today is in the Times, I guess, ran a story that a French company was planning to buy Lucent, and the French company's stock was dropping badly because of that story. And Lucent, for heaven's sakes, it's the old Bell Laboratories. They invented the transistor, and somebody mentions buying them, and their stock goes, you know.
Mm-hmm.
What was more stable at one time than AT&T and Bell Laboratories?
Well, AT&T as a company has certainly evolved in some people's vocabulary, mutated in other people's vocabulary, and I won't use words that fit into some people's vocabulary as to what the company has become over the past, let's say, 20 years. Put it this way, there is a vast difference between the AT&T of grandma's stock and grandma's company and the AT&T and its various offspring in today's day and age, as there is in the industry.
Yeah.
It's a totally different industry.
One last question. Are there any stocks that are recognized today as widows and orphans stocks? And I'll hang up and listen.
Okay. Thanks for the call.
Yeah, that's a great question, and I think maybe the first thing I would address is what I think has always been a misnomer, and that is the widows and orphans stock. To literally think that, again, an investment in equities is something as safe as mother's milk or should be the appropriate holding in its entirety for any person of very conservative needs and situations, the widow, the orphan, has probably been, again, a misnomer for as long as it's been in the investing vocabulary. My belief is 30 years ago, AT&T was certainly much safer a stock and all of its offspring included in that statement as it compares to today. But AT&T even 30 years ago was not an appropriate holding for people that you would say in the broad base category of being the widows and orphans investors. Bottom line is equities are risky. Risk is not bad, but risk should be understood. So when a person starts talking about individual equities, they have to realize that they are sacrificing some of the diversifiable potential they have in eliminating individual company risk. I am not a pure advocate of entirely indexing all of one's investments, but I do constantly remind people that when they move away from having indexed investments, whether it's in equities, fixed income, or whatever asset class into individual assets, they are assuming more risk by default. They will be taking on more risk. More risk means higher returns, certainly, as a potential. More risk means the potential for losses increased. So that's something to be cognizant of.
Hmm. So this, going back to this phrase, the widows and orphans stock, implies that there was some time that we thought that there was securities that were so secure, mm-hmm, that the risk was almost nothing. So that if you said to yourself, I have this much money, this is my nest egg, I cannot afford to lose anything, people would have said, well, okay, I tell you, your blue chips, companies like AT&T, or maybe one time it might have been IBM or Xerox, those companies that were very big, seemed very stable, they had share prices that were like a rock.
Exactly.
They just never changed. Well, of course, nowadays, those aren't the companies that would be on your list anymore. Maybe sometime fairly recently it would have been Microsoft. And so you're saying they're just – maybe there was never such a thing, but certainly now there's not.
I think people were doing themselves a disservice in the past when whether it was a telephone utility or an electric utility was considered to be a widow's and orphan's investment. And maybe I'm beating it up in too strong a fashion. It's not that's not warranted. But as a strict interpretation of the widows and orphans investments, yeah, we still have classifications that we would say are, you know, the safer type of stocks, that we'd use the vocabulary widows and orphans stocks even today. Mm-hmm. But literally to act it out and to say that those investments would be investments that people should have substantial placements of substantial parts of their wealth invested in was never prudent then, and it's certainly not prudent now. Industries change over time. And as regulated monopolies go, 30 years ago, electric utilities, telephone utilities have evolved. They are not the companies they used to be. And they've only shown us that mom was right. We just don't want to put all of our eggs in one basket.
I have a couple of minutes left. If someone has a question, they call right now. We'll get them in. 333-WILL, toll free 800-222-WILL. Just maybe for a second, I might go back to you touched briefly on the idea of investing internationally, and the idea being that that foreign markets don't move in lockstep with the American market, and so the idea might be, well, if our market's down, maybe their market's up.
Mm-hmm.
If you were looking at some place now, you were thinking about putting some of your money, and you can go into a mutual fund that invests in East Asia or Europe or places like that. Is there a particular place that you think works best that way that seems to be the mirror image of the U.S. stock market?
Unfortunately, there's no opportunity to say here is the classic, or here is the typical, or here is certainly the expected counter-cyclical investment. In other words, even if we could identify a market that was exactly inversely related with the United States market, you'd have to look at that and say, well, if I put a dollar in each one, I'd actually be in a riskless situation, wouldn't I? What one made, the other lost. Hence, my return is a riskless rate of return. Well, heck, it's a lot simpler just to put one's money in treasury bills and receive the riskless rate because they have no risk of investment. So the opportunity to diversify internationally is not in seeking a goal or in an attempt to find the perfect countercyclical or the perfect negative correlation relationship. We are trying to find relationships that are less than perfectly positive in their correlations. And to answer that question or to look for those opportunities, I think a person should look at international markets globally. So in addition to Europe, in addition to Asian, in addition to South American markets, that's where international diversification really brings its benefits. It's not a bet in any one place on the globe. It is an investment in all places on the globe.
Well, are there funds that are essentially total international market indices?
There are two approaches to take. There are certainly international mutual funds that literally invest globally. There are mutual funds that are foreign mutual funds, so to speak, so they'll have a concentration in South American equity markets or Asian equity markets. And it's a personal choice, I suppose, in terms of how a person wants to allocate their investable funds. It's something that will certainly depend upon how much they're investing. There may be a better way to tackle it if the investment is a small amount and therefore not require a whole lot of different mutual funds or a whole lot of different investments. So it's doable, however we find it appropriate to do.
Okay. Well, I think we're getting just about the point where we need to close up for this time around. We want to say thanks very much.
Thank you, David. Always enjoy being here.
Our guest, Kevin Wasby, is a lecturer in the Department of Finance here at the University of Illinois. Of course, we want you to think very carefully about your investments and seek out as much information as you possibly can. And a couple of other opportunities to learn about the workings of the markets are, first of all, the program Wall Street Week with Lou Rukeyser. You can see that Friday nights at 7:30 on our companion station WILL television. And then we air the audio portion of the show Saturday mornings at 11. In addition to that, we have this program here called Sound Money that airs on Saturday mornings at 10. It's a program that covers various investing and financial topics. And there's also an opportunity to call in and ask questions. So that's another show that you might check out. Sound Money, Saturday mornings at 10, right here on AM 580.